Hi everyone, this is Vishen Lakhiani with Finer Minds and the Mind Valley Way. The person I have on the phone right now is Professor Sri Kumar Rao. And since we released the first teleseminar interview with Sri Kumar, there's been such an amazing response to this man's work, we had to bring him back for a second round interview with me. Now, Sri Kumar, if you haven't heard of him, he is one of the most highly rated lecturers at some of the top MBA business schools in the world. I'm talking Columbia, the London Business School, the University of California at Berkeley, Kellogg. But what makes him so special is really what he speaks of. Sri Kumar basically teaches a course called Creativity and Personal Mastery. And this program is about taking control of your life. And this course has become so popular that he has a wait list to get into his classes. He's been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, Time Magazine, Fortune, the London Times, the USA Today. And he has a book out, he has a home study course. But the most amazing thing is his program is such a hit in business schools in the US and the UK that he is the only business school lecturer to have his own alumni association. In other words, students are so fired up and empowered by what they learn from him that after the class, they feel they need to join an alumni association to be in touch with other students of Sri Kumar Rao. And we have the man on the phone right now. Sri Kumar, how are you today?
I'm wonderful, Vishen, and very glad to be on this program with you.
Thanks. And the last interview we did, I learned a ton. I know the audience learned a ton, so we decided we had to bring you back. So for those people who are listening in and who are new to your work, in 2 or 3 minutes, could you quickly summarize what it is that we do, what it is that you do, and what is it that gives you such a massive fan following?
When persons take my program, Vishen, they find their lives transformed. It's really as simple as that. Their lives are transformed, and I don't do the transformation. The very powerful ideas that I share with them affect that transformation. You work with those ideas, and your life will change. It changes in a number of different dimensions. For one, you feel much more comfortable in your own skin. You feel at peace with the world. You have a recognition that there are powerful forces who are looking after you, and you don't have to be stressed out, unhappy, worried all the time, which unfortunately is a default state for most of us. You go to a different default state, and in this different default state, you are at peace, you're appreciative of all the good things that have been bestowed on you and the tremendous good that there is in the universe, and you have a commitment to add to that general good. So those are the changes that happen, and that's why it's so powerful.
And for those of you listening in, it might help if you actually had a chance to listen to the first interview, because both interviews sort of work together. But what we're going to do in this interview is we're going to go, Sri Kumar, we're going to go straight to more advanced ideas and lessons. I'm not going to ask you to cover the basic stuff again. And something else that's going to happen in this interview is Sri Kumar is actually going to teach us a couple of the exercises that he has taught companies and individuals all around the world that have transformed their lives. In fact, funny thing is, how I learned about him was through a Google video that was on video.google.com, and it was a video of Sri Kumar actually in the Google headquarters, putting Google staff through a life-transforming exercise. And this was one of the most highly rated Google videos out there. I watched the video, was very extremely inspired by it. And that's how I ended up getting in touch with Sri Kumar. So Sri Kumar, let's go on to some of the juicy stuff. One of the things you said is that you claim that you have a better method of networking, one that enables anyone to form a very deep relationship that lasts forever. Now, of course, this is tremendous value to anyone. So tell us more.
All right. First of all, Vishen, would you agree that networking is extremely important?
It is it's a cornerstone of my business. It's one of the most important skills I feel any entrepreneur needs.
Wonderful. And having seen you in operation, I know that you kind of use the techniques that I am about to share with you. Once again, I use the word technique advisedly, because what I'm advocating is a way of life and not a technique. But, you know, for purposes of convenience, I'll say technique. And I happen to see that you use it unconsciously, but I'm now going to lay it out in the open so you can recognize what it is you're doing, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing. most of the people, I would say probably about 70% of the persons who take my program will readily agree, you know, networking is a wonderful thing and networks are important, but they basically feel uncomfortable at the thought of networking. And in fact, one of the reasons they take my program is because they've heard about the incredible things you learn in there, and networking is one part of it. So that's part of the attraction, the reason why persons take the program. Now, typically, when most people think about networking, and typically the way it is taught can be summarized up as figure out who could potentially help you sometime in the future and come up with a means to come up with a method to ingratiate yourself with that person. Got that? Figure out who could be of help to you in the future. Come up with a method of ingratiating yourself with that person. It is inherently me-centered. And this is something which persons at some level do not feel comfortable with it, which is why a lot of the times persons say, oh, you know, I don't know how to network. I don't feel comfortable with it. And the way it is traditionally taught and understood, it is self-centered. It is me-centered. And it's not a very good way of doing it, because even if you succeed in doing it, you pay a very high psychic cost and it's just not worth it. Now, I invite you to go further. If you have the thought vision, now think about this because this is important. If you have the thought, oh, you know, my business would be much better or my life would be much better if I had a network, so I should go out and form a network. Even the thought that you want to form a network is inherently self-serving, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The very notion. Okay, and that is my whole point. The very notion that you have to form a network, that a network is good for you professionally, is self-serving. So my take on that is very simple. The way to form an extremely powerful, deep, and long-lasting network is not to try. Don't try to form a network. Don't try to create a network. Don't try to build a network. Expunge the thought of, I have to have a network, from your head altogether. Don't even try. Don't even start, because the very notion that you're going to start creating a network is self-serving. So what do you do if you don't even try to create one? What you do is you let a network evolve around you. It will spring up, and you allow it to spring up. You do not try to create it. That's extremely important. You let it happen. You don't try to make it happen. And the way you do that is the following. Have you visioned during the course of your life ever run into persons who inspire you, and some of whom inspire you very deeply? You read about them in magazine articles. You might watch them on television. You hear about them from friends. You actually observe them in action in some setting. Does that ever happen to you?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. And it happens to everyone. Now, what happens when we are inspired by someone who strikes a chord in us, someone who makes us feel good about ourselves, someone who makes us feel good? It's wonderful that there is such a person in the world who's doing what he or she does. Typically, what happens is we feel inspired, and we remain inspired for anywhere from, you know, 5 minutes to half a day, and then life goes on. Right?
Right.
This is a tremendous mistake, because every time you feel deeply inspired by someone you hear about, learn about, watch, that's the universe tapping you on the shoulder and saying, hey, buddy, there's something in this for you. Pay attention. So what I advocate is very simple. Take around with you a journal, a notebook or something. Every time you are inspired by whoever it is, note it down. Where did you learn about this person? What does this person do? What is it about this that you heard, read, or observed that inspired you? Make a record of that. And then go back to it after a few days or a few weeks and see which of these instances that you have recorded still inspire you, still bring up that good feeling inside you, and then you reach out to that person. And you reach out to that person with a sincere, heartfelt note. Here is how I learned about you. This is what struck me about it. And this is what really made me feel good that you were doing what you're doing. But then you follow up with a specific offer of help. This is what I would like to do in order to help you do what you are already doing. And I don't have to tell you that you do not reach out with such an offer of help unless you are fully prepared to deliver on it if called to. But the reason you reach out in this manner is if your offer of help is accepted, then you will be doing something that makes the world a better place, and you feel good about this, and that is the reason that you're reaching out. You're not reaching out from a narrow self-interest point of view of, you know, I've got to build a network. You're reaching out because you're actually going to do something which will make the world a better place, and you feel good about doing it. When you reach out from this emotional space, you're reaching out from a values basis and not a self-interest basis. And when you reach out on a values basis, it is an inherently powerful method. You know it, the person to whom you're reaching out also knows it, and the action you get, the reaction you get is very different from when you're reaching out in a self-interest basis. Now, in my program, I have an exercise where I encourage persons to do it on a systematic basis. I recommend reaching out at least once a week. And many say, well, I can't do once a week, but I can do once every 2 weeks or once. So whatever the frequency is, you decide, but do it consistently. Make it a part of your life. And if you do that in a relatively short time, within 18 months to 2 years, enough of your offers of help will have been accepted. And in the process of delivering what you said you would do, you will build up a relation. Don't have to give any thoughts to it. It happens automatically. And they will be very deep relationships, and they will be very long-lasting relationships. And you never have to ask the person to look after your interests. They will do it in ways that you could not even conceive of. It happens all the time.
That's definitely a very radical, extremely radical suggestion. I mean, my question is, if we're offering to give help to all these people, I mean, if we're dealing with someone who is extremely successful, who has inspired us, what type of help could we possibly give them?
That is where the challenge comes in, Vishen. I can't tell you how many persons said, well, you know, I want to help this person, but, you know, he or she has everything and they're so well known. What could I possibly do? It is your challenge to come up with some means which is within your capacity to deliver. And it's not that difficult to do. For example, if the person is extremely well known, you may not be able to get through to the person, but you can invariably get through to his or her administrative assistant, secretary, or whatever. And you can simply say, here is who I am, this is what I do, I really would like to help this person in this project. Can you tell me what kind of help would be most useful? Or you could simply send a, you know, ask for, you know, here are my skills, in what way could I possibly be of help to you? And not, you won't be successful every time, but you'll be successful enough of the time that you won't have time to think about all the times when you were not successful. The challenge is for you to come up with what is it that I can offer and how is it that I can tailor it so that it is particularly useful to this person. That's the challenge.
And
look upon it as an intellectual challenge. It can be done. Believe me, it can be done.
You are absolutely right. In fact, I have, and you are right when you said I've been doing this unconsciously. I've had the pleasure of working with some amazing people. I recently got to hang out with Richard Branson on his private island. I got to spend some time with Paula Abdul in her home. And thinking back, I realized that a lot of this happened simply because I reached out to help them. There were people who had inspired me. And
you
I reached
got it.
Out to help them. With Paula Abdul, I spent around 5 hours with her, teaching her how to get her online marketing together. I helped her get on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It's a really funny story. But absolutely, I can see how this totally works. And what you're saying
and here's one
so
other point
sense.
I want to stress up there, stress Vishen. Uh-huh. The more successful a person is, the more well-known, the higher profile, the easier it is to get to them if you take the approach that I'm approaching you from a value standpoint
right. As
opposed to a self-interest standpoint.
Right.
Because from a self-interest standpoint, everybody is reaching out to them, and many of these famous people have armies of other people whose sole job is to keep you away from them.
Very, very, very true.
But so, when you reach out from a values perspective, you change the game completely.
Very true. So thank you for that enlightening idea on networking. Now, another area that you have some really radical, amazing ideas on is the concept of leadership. So let's talk about that. How does your program help people become better leaders in their community, in their business, in life?
All right. I have a somewhat different take on leadership vision, so let me share that with you first. Typically, when we talk about leadership here, we automatically say, oh, such and such a person is a leader. And typically we say such and such a person is a leader because he or she is in a position of hierarchical authority, like the CEO of a major firm or the head of a division or, you know, head of an organization, or, you know, he's got the title of head. And therefore we say here is a leader. In reality, just because you're head of an organization, it doesn't mean that you are a leader. If you're head of an organization, it simply means that you are exactly that. You're in a position of hierarchical authority, and in that position of hierarchical authority, you can do many things, some of which good, some of which is bad. You have a certain amount of coercive power because you have the ability to reward or punish, and when you have a certain amount of coercive power, people will do to a certain extent what you would like them to do, but that does not make you a leader. In my book, you are a leader if you can inspire a person to reach the highest level that he or she is capable of reaching. In other words, your job as a leader is to ensure that all of the people whom you are responsible for achieve their potential. And it is your job to inspire them to reach their highest potential and do whatever it is that you can to enable this to happen. That is your function. And when you have a large number of people who say, this person transformed my life, he made it possible for me to do what I did, then you are a leader. So it's a very different take on leadership. And by the way, this has profound implications on business. Would you like me to share some of how it plays out in business?
Absolutely, yes.
Let's take customer service vision. I've never come across a business yet that doesn't say, yes, we want to deliver great customer service. Would you agree?
Right.
All right. Now, typically, let's see how a typical company deals with, we want to deliver great customer service. How do they go about doing it? The first thing that they do is they say, okay, let's define what we mean by great customer service. So you come up with a bunch of metrics. Every call from a customer has to be resolved within the first contact. Every phone call has to be picked up within the first two rings, you know, stuff like that. So you come up with 10, 15, 20, 50 different parameters, correct?
Uh-huh.
And then you say, if we reach this, then we're delivering great customer service. So then it comes down to, now that we've defined what great customer service is, let's talk about where we are. So you benchmark where you are relative to where you would like to be. Sometimes you go one step further and you benchmark an industry leader and say, here's where we would like to be, here's where the industry leader is, here's where we are, and we've got to plug that gap. So how do you plug that gap? You identify which are the areas where you need to improve. And then you come up with training programs, and you put an enormous amount of effort into coming up with incentives and punishments. You don't call it punishments, but it's exactly that. So you come up with a carrot and stick approach, and then you implement it, and you hope that because you've spent so much time in coming up with these carrots and with sticks, and you've designed your training program well, you hope that you'll get to great customer service. Sometimes it works. Very often it doesn't work. Now, the reason it doesn't work, this is important, is that great customer service has nothing to do with the customer. It has everything to do with the employee. Because when the employee delivers great customer service, he or she knows it. And not only knows it, but feels good about himself or herself, becomes engaged in what he or she is doing, wants to get up on Monday morning and come to work because, hey, I'm helping people. I feel good about doing it. I love my job. So the function of a manager is to find out and encourage this feeling among the employees that when you're delivering great customer service, you're doing it for you. You're not doing it for me. You're not doing it for the company. You're doing it with you. And whatever benefits come to the company is a byproduct, but you're doing it for you. And not only preach this message, but walk the talk so the function of the manager then becomes, what is it that is preventing my people from delivering great customer service and eliminating that systematically one by one? It is not the function of a leader to motivate his employees. Employees are inherently motivated. It is the function of the leader to find out what is demotivating them and getting rid of it systematically. It's a completely different take from what is commonly understood.
I like that. And I want to share a personal experience with that philosophy. But before I go there, for those of you listening in, I just want to point out that if you'd like to learn more about Sri Kumar Rao and the amazing programs that he puts out, scroll down on the page that you're listening to this audio on, scroll down and you'll see a button that says click here to learn more. Go ahead, click on that button, do it now if you can, and you'll come to a page where you'll hear about his home study program. Now keep in mind that there's a waiting list to get into Sri Kumar's classes at a Columbia Business School. And where are you teaching right now, Sri Kumar?
I'm teaching privately, Vishen, and I'm offering my course in New York. I will offer it in London later this year and in sometime next year in California.
Awesome.
And there are plans to offer it in other major metropolitan areas, but they're not crystallized yet.
Got it. And what was the last university you were associated with?
London Business School. London I just Business finished School. Teaching at London Business School.
That's amazing. So keep in mind that there's a waiting list to get into his programs, and his programs are constantly ranked as one of the top programs at these Ivy League MBA schools. But on the next page, when you if you click on that button, you'll see how you can get access to some of Sri Kumar's most powerful ideas in the form of a home study course for just a tiny fraction of that price. Now, let's go on with the interview. Sri Kumar, I was really struck by one of the things you just said about leadership. And if I may, I just want to share a little story with you and the audience of how your philosophy had helped shape our company and change the way we
Absolutely.
Do things in our company. Now, we arrived on this through a whole bunch of different readings, and you were definitely one of the teachers who had influenced this. But I've been in leadership positions for most of my life, but until recently, my definition of leadership came from Dwight Eisenhower, and that was the following. Dwight Eisenhower said, leadership is getting other people to do things you want done because they want to do it. And I thought, 5 years ago, I thought this was powerful stuff. This was awesome. But now looking back, I realized that this is really a crappy style of leadership. It's something that belonged in the 1950s, but isn't really applicable right now. It's a leadership that's based on coercion, on manipulation, on propaganda. It's on the idea of getting other people to do stuff you want done without them realizing that you are getting them to do it for yourself. Okay, and over time, I can think back of positions I had in companies where I applied this style of leadership, and I got stuff done, but it wasn't done in a very fulfilling way. I didn't have rock star teams, and I just don't believe in this process anymore. Recently, my style of leadership changed, and I want to share with you a quote which I had shared with my team. The quote is this: leadership is recognizing that we are all one, that every person you lead is as brilliant as you, as talented as you, and has the same capacity for growth and accomplishment that you have. But very often, they simply need to be reminded of this fact. Your job as a leader is to nudge them, to remind them, and to help them fly. And when I changed my philosophy, the quote I just gave you is a personal quote, but when I changed that philosophy, I found that the things that happened in my business were amazing. The last 1 year, I decided that my primary goal of as a founder in my business was not to be the marketing expert or the HR expert or the customer acquisition expert, but was to simply clone myself by hiring smart people and training them to be these experts. And as a result, the last 1 year of our business was the biggest growth period we ever had. We were growing by maybe 15-20% a year. The last 1 year, we grew revenues by 500%, profits by 1,000%. We went from a 20-person company to a 50-person company. And a lot of it, if I could credit one thing, was simply this difference in style of leadership. It was about growing and giving value to your employees and being fanatical about helping them grow rather than being the driver of the business yourself. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That is exactly the way it should be, Vishen. I just wish that we could have even a fraction of this implemented in some of our large organizations.
Yes, and you want to know the other crazy stuff, Sri Kumar? Employee turnover, basically reached zero.
Dropped dramatically.
It not only did it drop, it became almost non-existent. The only people turning over were people who were non-performers, and in some way or the other, we had to ask them to leave to make way for better performers. But employee turnover went down. Loyalty went up. Things got so crazy, Sri Kumar, that we had guys in our company who were crazy smart, who started their own business and were certainly earning income on the side, but still want to be part of our company, Mindvalley, because they love the amount of learning that they're getting from it.
And I will tell you something else which will happen. You will never again have to advertise for an opening because you will have a waiting list of resumes. So whatever position you can think of, you know, all you got to do is, you know, go down to your list and say, okay, we'll give this guy a chance.
And funnily enough, that's also true. We have actually pulled job ads on newspapers and all across the web. We no longer advertise because we have a waiting list of people wanting to get into this company.
Yep. And I can tell you something else that's going to happen. I'm going to mention your company. I'm going to talk about it to my alumni group. They're going to talk about it to others. And next thing you know, you're going to get a whole bunch of people who want to check you out.
Well, thank you.
You're in Malaysia, and many people won't want to go there. But sooner or later, you're going to grow big enough that you'll say, hey, we need to have an operation in New York, in London, wherever. And you will find that you are besieged with people. Your problem is going to be, how do I say no to so many wonderful people?
Well, yes, I know. And that's a great problem to have. And thank you for letting me share that. I thought it would be a great testimonial and evidence that a lot of the stuff that you talk about really works. You see, I'm speaking to the audience here listening in. I used to think that the key to growing my business as an entrepreneur was being a hotshot marketer. And so I poured myself into learning marketing products. And, you know, I grew the business by 15, 20, maybe in a good year, 50%. But that 500% growth happened when I stopped focusing on training myself, but on rather training my employees, on turning them into hotshot marketers. And now we have, I used to be the number one marketing guy in my company. That's no longer the case. Now I have maybe four or five people who are, if not as brilliant as me, better than me. And so the company is growing far more rapidly because my time is limited. But now I have 50 employees who are able to grow the company on their own without me having to be involved directly.
Yes, that's the way it should be.
Okay, now,
because
now,
what you are is, you don't have a, here's another way of thinking about it, Vishen. You're not growing the company. What you're doing is creating a vehicle for transformation. And in your particular line of business, that's particularly powerful because you're creating a vehicle of transformation, not only for those who are within the organization for their personal development, but by virtue of the nature of the business you're in, you're propagating a message which will lead to this transformation in hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of people outside. That is hugely powerful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's go on to another key idea of yours, and this is something that I find a little bit mystifying. Okay, now you say that you dislike rewards or incentives, and you also dislike punishment. But if you don't push both, how can a business survive without these two?
Okay, this is extremely interesting, Vishen, and actually I would like you to go back to the work of Deming.
Okay.
When Deming, as you know, and I'm sure most of your readers know, was the person who was responsible for getting Japanese industry back on its feet after the tremendous destruction caused by World War II. And Deming was an American, and he had come up with his idea of statistical process quality control and a whole bunch of other things, but he did not have much of a hearing here. But the Japanese embraced his ideas, and we all know what resulted from that, including powerhouses such as Toyota, Honda, Sony, and so on. And he was so much revered in Japan that the most prestigious prize they can give there is actually the Deming Prize. But he's got a whole bunch of principles, and one of those is do not reward and do not punish. In other words, the very act of evaluating persons is counterproductive. And he's got a ton of things to say on that. But let me tell you what my problem is, and I especially am against the system that we have in the United States, and unfortunately it's becoming more common in most of the world, which is, quote, outsized, horrendous, monstrous rewards for some people and crumbs for everybody else. And in fact, that is getting a fair amount of press, and it's deserved that this be a subject that we evaluate very carefully. But here is where it comes down to. The moment you give somebody a reward and say, this is a reward that you're getting for doing a good job. And we do it all the way, right up from kindergarten, where we give gold stars to children and we reward them in various ways for getting good grades and so on. And there's a ton of research that's been done on this, which essentially shows that the moment you do that consistently and the moment people buy into it, what they start doing is they start focusing on the rewards and not on the intrinsic merit of the task. There has been research, for example, which shows that when you consistently praise a kid for being intelligent and doing well on tests, that becomes a goal in itself, and the kid will take easier courses because he can do well, and he will shy away from the difficult intellectual challenges because I may not do well and won't get the recognition. So the more you run your company on an incentive basis, the more people will focus on the incentive as opposed to what is it that I am doing, how is it contributing to my growth, how is it making society better. All of that focus is taken away and dumped upon the incentive. Mm-hmm. Exactly the opposite happens on when you have punishment, because instead of thinking about the intrinsic value or the merits of the task, you start focusing on how can I avoid the punishment. You do not want that to happen. So by far the best way of taking that out of the picture is to compensate your employees handsomely. But having done that, do your level best to get it out of the picture and put all of the emphasis on this is what you're doing, here is how it is helping you grow, and this is the good that we're doing to society, and let's all be part of this enterprise, which is, you know, for doing, let's all be part of this enterprise, which is doing good in the world. And when you do that, you have to have certain things. Everybody has to be well compensated. You've got to ensure that monstrous compensation, disproportionate perks are taken out of the picture and create a community or we are all in this together. And when you run into bad times, by the way, make sure that the people at the top give up proportionately more than you ask the people at the bottom to give up. So we are all together in this enterprise. We do need to make money. We do need to be compensated. But once that is done, we are all in this for a greater purpose. And that is what should be the focus of the organization.
I like that. And really, that's something that's so important for every business. I mean, even if you run a dry cleaning company, if you get your employees but passionate about delivering the best darn customer service, being the best darn dry cleaning business in your city, it could be something as simple as that. You really get way better performance from them.
Absolutely, that's the way to do it.
By the way, Vishen,
one of the things I would like to point out, that all of the things that I'm sharing with you, I would like your listeners not to think of it as techniques. Because once you think about it as these are techniques that I use to get what I want, then what you're doing is you're just being another manipulative person. I would like them to think of it as if I become one with all of these, then I'm not using it as a technique. I'm using it as an outward reflection of the person that I am. That's when it's really powerful.
That's very true. And you're making it a way of life.
Yes. That is the whole function of my course. I am not there to make people better managers so they can go out and get what they want and get other people to conform to what they would like them to behave. You were absolutely right, by the way. The way Eisenhower framed his quote, he was simply being a manipulative SOB.
Right.
You do not want to be manipulative. You genuinely want to bring out the best in people, and you want to bring out the best in people because that's what you were put on earth to do.
And now, Sri Kumar, in your book and in your programs, you also talk about unleashing the fountain of creativity. How does one do this?
Okay. Once again, my take is somewhat different from normal vision. And my take is that creativity is not about learning a bunch of techniques. creativity actually happens when you are so passionately involved in something that achieving it is far more important to you than anything that happens to you personally. And when you're completely wrapped up in a cause and you're passionate about it and you want to make that successful, then you really don't have to do anything about creativity. It kind of flowers internally, automatically. All you got to do is be in a position where you are that passionate about something which is important and something which brings a greater good to a greater community, as we talked about before. Once you are at that stage, if you read some of these techniques for sparking creativity, then they work well. But the primary thing that you can do to be more creative is to be passionate about whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish. Let it actually come in and become a part of you. Actually, there's a wonderful quote about that in my syllabus. Can I read that out to you?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay, give me just a second. I have to pull it up. This is far and away the best way of putting it, and I'll bring it up just a second. The best description of creativity vision actually comes from Inamori. Inamori is a legend in Japan. He was the founder of a company called Kyocera. And here's how he puts it. I often tell a researcher who is lacking in dedication, unless he is motivated with determination to succeed, he will not be able to go past the obstacles. When his passion, his desire, becomes so strong as to rise out of his body like steam, and when the condensation of that which evaporated occurs and drops back like raindrops, he will find his problem solved. And that is exactly what my take on creativity is. When you have that level of dedication to a cause bigger than yourself, the creativity will happen automatically. So you want to be more creative, learn to be passionate.
Thank you. That's a wonderful quote. And once again, I see the importance of making sure that the people in your team are inspired by a mission or a cause.
Yes. Now, I'm sure you find it in your company. Do you find that there are problems that came up and you were thinking, what do I have to do about it? And all of a sudden, you didn't have to do anything about it because somebody in your organization came up with a way of dealing with it, which was something you would never even have thought of?
Absolutely. That happens all the time.
That's the point. When you have people who are doing it because they are doing it to improve themselves, to feel good about themselves, they've taken ownership of it, then there isn't a whole lot you have to do. It happens automatically.
Yes.
And all you got to do is stand by and be grateful that it's happening.
Yes, no, that's very, very, very true. And if I may share another quick anecdote, which relates to the idea you just shared. In May this year, I spent maybe 6 days in the office. I spent instead 21 days of May on beaches around the world. I was in Fiji, I was in the Virgin Islands, I was in Cabo, beaches in three different countries, and only 6 days in the office. In that same month, we had our biggest ever sales month in the history of the company. We had our biggest ever revenue day in the history of the company. And all these new ideas came from my employees. And it was wonderful to be able to just get away, shut down my email and my phone, and know that I have people taking care of these things for me.
That's exactly the way it is. That's exactly the way it should be. I rest my case.
Yeah. So one more very interesting thing that you talk about is the idea that we should invest in the process and not the outcome. Can you speak more about this?
Sure. And this is hugely important also, Vishen. Think about how we traditionally define success. What happens from a very young age, we are inculcated in, you know, don't go around and waste your life. You have to have a plan. You have to have goals. You know, go ahead and set goals and work towards them, correct? Have you been told that?
Yes.
Do you see it happening to children? Do you see that happening in society all over?
Absolutely.
So what we do is we become a society who are obsessed with productivity. We become obsessed with, I got to set goals and I got to meet them. And what we do is we focus on the goals that we have set. Now, here is something that I would like you to think about, Vishen. Has it ever occurred to you, and I'm drawing it explicitly to your attention now, that you have some control over your actions and you have no control at all over outcome?
Right.
Correct? So what happens is some of the time you take action and you get the outcome that you want, but a lot of the time you do not get the outcome you want, and some of the time you get an outcome which is actually diametrically opposed to the outcome that you expected. I had someone, for example, who was traveling a lot. He was a busy executive, and he was neglecting his family. And he was in some European country, and he said, okay, I've been neglecting my wife. Let me buy a dress for her. And he went out and, you know, went to some trouble to get her an expensive dress. And he took it up as a token of, you know, I think about you and I love you. And what happened is she took one look at it and said, don't you know I never wear stuff like that? And we've been married 20 years, and you still don't know my dress size, and it went downhill from there. Stuff like that has happened to you, to me, to everyone. We expect an outcome. We work hard to get it. Some of the time, we do get the outcome we wanted. Much of the time, we do not get the outcome we wanted. And at least some of the time, the outcome we get is the precise opposite of what we expected. Well, what happens in our traditional goal-setting methodology is we focus on this is what I want to accomplish. We focus entirely on the outcome. And as I've just described to you, we rarely get the outcome we want. So when you focus on the outcome and you hitch your well-being to the achievement of a particular outcome, you're setting yourself up for failure, for disappointment, for rejection, depression, and all the rest of the things that make life suck. You're setting yourself up for it. But that's what we do all the time. We always focus on the outcome. This is what I need to. If I succeed, wonderful, life is great. If I don't, I failed, life is terrible. You're just setting yourself up for failure. You don't have to do that. And you don't have to do that by the following way. What happens is you decide this is where I want to do, and you spend enough time on it that it gives you direction. You set your goal, and now you have a direction. But once you've set your goal, and once you've decided on the actions, you stop focusing on the goal, but instead focus entirely on your actions, on the process, whatever it is that you're doing in order to get to your get to where you want to go. And all of your attention, your emotional energy is on that. And when you do that, that rewards you in and of itself. The doing of what you are doing, the labor itself, is your reward. That's why in my syllabus, the first quote is, to work is to pray. And work becomes prayer only when you do it with that attitude, which is, whatever I'm doing is important in its own right, and it will bless me, as opposed to, I will be rewarded if I achieve this outcome.
Right.
Perhaps the best example of this is a quote, which I also have in my syllabus, and this is a quote, I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't remember it exactly. It's from John Wooden. John Wooden was the first person to reach the Basketball Hall of Fame, both as a player and as a coach. And during his tenure, he led UCLA to an unprecedented set of victories in basketball in the UCLA. You know, I think they reached the finals, they got 10 titles, and, you know, final appearances in the last 15 years, something like that. But what he said was, when I start coaching, I never, ever speak to my team about winning or outscoring opponents. Instead, what I say is, when you look in the mirror, did you do the best that you were capable of? If you did the best that you were capable of, the score doesn't matter. But I have a suspicion that if you did the best you were capable of, the score will be to your liking. That is exactly it, the whole thing in a nutshell.
That's a beautiful quote. Thank you. I like that. It's about the journey and not the destination.
The journey is the only thing you have. If you get hung up on the destination, A, you'll find when you get to the destination, it isn't what you thought it would be, and you wasted the entire journey anyway. You're not going to be happy when you get something. You are going to be happy now. And if you're incapable of being happy now, you're certainly not going to do it when you achieve whatever it is that you're striving with might and main to achieve.
Well said. Thank you. Now, once again, for those of you listening, we have about 15 minutes to go. And if you want to learn more from Sri Kumar Rao, and keep in mind that many of these principles are not just applicable to people in business or MBA students. These are life principles which you can bring into your life. They'll help you enhance your relationship with people, your relationship with your friends, as Sri Kumar put it in our first interview, help you get out of bed every day and be put down on your knees in involuntary gratitude for how great things are going. I've read his book, I've studied his work, and it's made a profound difference to my business, to my life, and I'm hoping that you would take some time to look into his work and see if this might work for you. Now, Sri Kumar, one more interesting aspect of what you do is you talk about the concept of when we react with anger and frustration about things that don't go our way, it's really about what's inside of us. Could you clarify that?
Sure. Look upon how you run your life, Vishen, and most of your listeners run their life. You know, stuff happens, they get frustrated. And take a simple example. You're driving on a highway, and I don't know how things are in Malaysia, but all over the United States and the UK, you have enormous traffic jams. And you're stuck there in traffic, and somebody cuts you off rudely and almost causes an accident. What's your instinctive reaction? Your instinctive reaction is anger. What's this turkey doing here? You swear at him. You might stick a finger out. And if somebody were to ask you, why did you become angry? Your reaction is, well, I became angry because, you know, this person was, you know, almost caused an accident and was rude and inconsiderate. And you're reacting to other people's inconsideration, and that's why you become angry. Mm-hmm. But in reality, that's not why you became angry. You became angry because anger was inside you. Now, in India, we have a sweet called a rasgulla. Are you familiar with rasgulla?
Yes, I've heard of it.
Okay, rasgulla is a white sweet. It is approximately the size of a ping pong ball, and it comes in a very heavy sweet syrup. And you take a rasgulla and you eat it, and it's very, very, very sweet. It's one of the traditional sweets, particularly well known in Bengal. Now, you take a rasgulla and you drop it on the floor and step on it, and what comes out is sweet syrup. You take a rasgulla and put a suitcase on it or run over it with a car, and what comes out is a sweet syrup. Now, why does a sweet syrup come out of a rasgulla when you mistreat it? The reason a sweet syrup comes out of a rasgulla when you mistreat it is because that's what's in the rasgulla, and what's in the rasgulla is what comes out, no matter what you do with it, no matter how you mistreat it, ill-treat it, deform it in whatever way. That's what comes out because that's what's in it. Now, when life mistreats you by giving you stuff you don't want, by putting you into uncomfortable situations, by mistreating you, what comes out? Anger, rage, frustration, depression. Don't make the mistake of saying this came out because that happened to you. This came out because that is what was inside you. And whenever you are jolted by life, what comes out is what's inside you. That's always a good thing for you to remember. What comes out has nothing to do with what happened outside. What comes out is what was inside you. And when you transform what is inside you, your reaction is completely, completely different. The Buddha, for example, blessed the person who fed him poison. Mahatma Gandhi said, "Hey Ram," and he was thinking of God at the time when he was shot. What comes out of these people is what is inside them. What comes out of you is what is inside you. And if you want to progress, if you want to reach a higher level of consciousness, what you have to do is systematically transform the crap that is inside you. And once you do that, you will find that you no longer react with anger, you no longer react the way you traditionally do. You will react in a different way, and the reason you react in a different way is because there is other stuff inside you.
That's deep. I was just thinking about that and thinking about situations in my own life where I could see that happen. Mm-hmm. So how then do we change what's inside us?
The way you change what's inside you is by adopting different models, by having a different worldview, by doing things like the appreciation gratitude exercise, recognizing that you're not the center of the universe, but you are there to be a service. And as you progressively use many of the viewpoints that I share in my book, in my CD program, in my talks, what happens as you systematically start thinking about them is you start transforming the stuff that's inside you. You start taming the unruly emotions and transmuting them, and it's a slow, gradual process. But once you get to a certain point in this process, you no longer have to take conscious thought of it. It happens automatically.
Right.
That's the beauty of it. The universe is always working to help you reach that level.
And for those of you listening in, these concepts Sri Kumar just spoke of, the concept of expression of gratitude, understanding your mental models, understanding the me-centered universe, you will learn about this in his program if you scroll down and click on Learn More. Or if you you'll hear a quick summary of them in the first interview that we had, which is also available on the same website. Now, finally, Sri Kumar, we have time for one more question.
And, okay.
I want to ask you about this. You say we are not really free, but that we are in fact imprisoned by our own demons. What do you mean by this?
Okay. Freedom is a big thing, Vision, or a big thing in the sense of it's an important concept, and we all want to be free. And in the United States particularly, we are very, very, very touchy about any infringement of our freedom. But what we do is we always define it externally, Vision. We define it in terms of, I don't want anybody to have, we define it externally in terms of, I don't want anybody to place restrictions on what I can do or what I want to do. Mm-hmm. All right? So therefore, I have to have the freedom to bear arms. I have to have the freedoms to take whatever job I want, to speak what I have in mind, et cetera, et cetera. And this is freedom, and we define it entirely in terms of, what is it that others do to restrict what I want to do? But we never stop to think about, what about internal freedom? Do I have the freedom to do whatever it is I want to do? Think about the number of persons who are obese and overweight, and they all want to be slim, and they know in order to be slim, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out. All you got to do is eat less and exercise more. Easier said than done, right?
Right.
Because we are imprisoned by our own cravings, by our indulgences, by our lack of ability to do something which we know is in our best interest and we should be doing, and we can't do it. We are driven by our conditioned impulses. We are driven by our bigoted fantasies. We are completely, completely enthralled with our own, enthralled to our own minds. We lack the capacity to sit down in a chair and sit quietly by ourselves for a half hour. We're not even talking large lengths of time. You just sit down quietly by yourself for a half hour, and most of us are unable to do that. When you are unable to be with yourself quietly for a half hour, Vision, how free are you really? That is what I want to get everybody who takes my program to think about.
Thank you, Sri Kumar. A lot of the stuff you talk about requires us to sometimes pause and digest, just because you do deal at a very profound level. And I know 1 hour is definitely not enough time to get all your knowledge and ideas out, but thank you so much for this. This is the second interview we've had, and once again, I've learned a ton of stuff, and I'm hoping our listeners have learned a ton of stuff. So thank you, and those of you listening, thank you for calling in and listening. To learn more, scroll down, click on the link, and there will be a special package put together for you where you'll be able to get access to some of Sri Kumar's programs. And as usual, when we do one of these teleseminars, we always make sure that when you buy the program immediately following the teleseminar interview, you get it at either a discounted price or with some additional bonuses. So you're always getting a great deal. Sri Kumar, thank you so much. Any closing words before we part ways?
I sincerely hope that your listeners found this useful. And what I would like them to do is pick any one idea that really struck them and implement it. This is where the rubber meets the road. If you simply listen to it, 1 week from now, you'll remember that you had a good feeling, but it will not have changed your life. But pick any one of the ideas that appeal to you and actually implement it in your life, and that will change your life.
Right on. Thank you, Sri Kumar. This was awesome.
My pleasure, Vision.
Okay, and everyone, thank you for listening. Take care and have an amazing evening.